You have my background?
No, we've just basically spent our time talking about getting together.
Okay, well, let me introduce myself. I'm Dorothy Miner, and from 1975 until 1994, November 94, I was the lawyer for the Landmarks Preservation Commission.
Oh.
But I started even before that. I was at the Environmental Defense Fund, but I was doing volunteer work for the commission. So I was involved from the appeal in Grand Central on, working closely with the law department.
When you say the commission?
The Landmarks Commission. That's the commission in my life.
Okay. No.
Yes,
I understand that.
And so
we probably knew each other in those days.
Right, we did. And when there was a centennial anniversary for the law, somebody got the old archives and even pulled a letter from my father to your committee. My father was a history professor at Columbia. And there was my father urging the passage of the Landmarks Law. You and
you
did your job. Your father.
Well, I think it was out of
sight. But I showed up for that anniversary
down there.
It was probably the 15th anniversary.
Whatever.
Well,
yeah, was
I mean
we
the
15th,
the 15th, the 20th, 25th, 30th.
But I remember the 15th was 1980, and I was working for Kent Barwick, who was then chair of the Landmarks Commission.
Kent Barwick.
Yes. The Municipal Arts Society,
was also,
then and later.
Yeah,
didn't he go upstate?
For a while he was running the New York Historical Association out of Cooperstown, right. He's always had family roots in Cooperstown.
Is he up there now?
No, he did that for a few years and then came back and is now again running the Municipal Arts Society.
He is?
Yet another level of...
Because I had told him I had that...
Your certificate from the society, right.
At the time, I couldn't find it.
Right.
So I don't know what he seemed to be interested in at the time. But I didn't even remember his name. So I made a copy, and I sent the original over to the archives at the LaGuardia Wagner Archives at LaGuardia Community College. Are you familiar with that?
I've heard of them, but I'm not sure what all is there. Would you happen to know if one of the things I'm interested in trying to track down is kind of the legislative history of the Landmarks Law. Do you think anything from that period from the council might have ended up in that collection?
I tell you, you have to call Dr. Lieberman.
Lieberman?
And I have his phone number, but not here in the other office. Give it to you.
Thanks a lot, because I've heard that there are some interesting papers.
He's starting up the collection. And so I don't know how far they've gotten. Do you know the name of Edelstein? He was Wagner's executive assistant.
No, that is not a name I'm familiar with.
And Julius Edelstein.
Oh, yes, I'm familiar with that one.
Yeah.
Wasn't Robert Sweet there, too? At the time, as one of his other assistants?
I think he was. Then he became a judge.
Yes, he's a federal judge now. Right. And then also, there was Chris Niebuhr was a staff person to them. He started law school with me, but never finished, and he went to business, and he was there. Did you ever come across Chris?
No, remember him. Yeah. I can visualize him
now.
Yeah. But...
Well, we will check and see what he has there. Just for purposes, I forgot at the beginning.
He may want what you've got.
Well, hopefully we'll have a lot of shared interest. I'm just going to, for the purposes of the tape, indicate that this is our interview with Bob Lowe on July 16th, 2002, and it's Tony Wood with Dorothy Miner. The voices will be distinguishable to whoever has to transcribe this at some point. Well, thanks so much for meeting with us. Let me explain briefly kind of what we're up to, and then we'll zero in on the area you might be able to shed some light on for us. Both Dorothy and I have been very interested in capturing the history of the preservation movement in New York City, and we both kind of looked at different pieces of that story, but we're both particularly interested in, obviously, the law, because that's where it all comes together. And Dorothy and I are on the board of a group called the New York Preservation Archive Project, which is a new nonprofit whose purpose is trying to tell that story and capture the papers and memories of people before they're lost, and also celebrating that history and doing public programs and educating people to how the Landmarks Law came into being, and then also continuing the sense of the history of preservation after the law and helping organizations, you know, document their own history with the idea that somebody's going to care in 20 or 30 years how certain preservation things happen.
Would that include the Environmental Income
impact statement?
Our particular focus at the moment, just because of, you know, limited time and energy, is primarily the landmarks preservation law and the commission. Mm-hmm. As we focus on certain preservation battles, if you will, over particular buildings or sites, I think that will also bring us into some of the environmental issues, because those issues always, not always, but many of the time, became part of the larger debate. So, and some of the environmental laws created opportunities to have projects reviewed. So.
And also, since it's so important that the definition of the environment in New York City and New York State includes historic resources, which, you know, isn't necessarily what everybody expects it to include, it has been important. I just want to clarify that the project doesn't necessarily hold the archives that they try to track down themselves. They want to make sure they're preserved. They don't want to make sure they hold them. So that's why seeing where they are is what the important thing is.
Have you checked in also with the two resources at the city? There is an archive.
The Municipal Archive is a place we haven't, I have not myself yet gone for my research.
And then there's the library. I think it's called the library, which used to be in the municipal building, and they had a heck of a collection of stuff there, but I'm not sure which, in connection with getting rid of my prints and certificates and all that, I was calling around a little.
Oh,
it turned out there are two units down there, and I may even have that in the other room there.
And would that be like the New York City Municipal Library?
Yes, that's right. Exactly the name of it.
Okay. It's so logical.
You have to
it.
Have those two involved.
Yeah, absolutely. That's
I don't know what they're doing, but there used to be a man when I was active, Dorothy, you were down there, who was a heck of a good man, and he was running the New York Municipal Library, and I don't remember his name offhand. I'm sure he's long out of there.
Well, what we wanted to try and take you back to was the time around the landmarks there, but to kind of set the stage, in the fall of 1964, you were a member of the New York City Council. And I was curious what district you represented and what party affiliation you had, and just help us kind of understand your role on the council.
Well, I was elected in 1962. If you will remember, I'm not trying to be snide, but Wagner ran against himself in that election. In other words, he had been supported by the five district county leaders. But in 61, he ran with the support of the so-called reform movement, which was headed up by Mrs. Roosevelt, Tom Finletter, who had been, I think, the Secretary of the Air Force, and a third person whose name I don't remember quickly, but I could pull it out. And so I had been working as an assistant in Wagner's office, and I came from his local district, and had been in his local Tammany Club. And I ended up taking on Wagner's own political leader in the district with his acquiescence, if not more, because I think he had his picture taken with me when I ran in the primary, etc. So. It was a rather, that's an unusual election that occurred. As a matter of fact, I think it was Wagner in that election of 61 who beat Arthur Levitt's father, who was the candidate of Carmine DiSapio and the old organization. I hope you got the pronunciation there. So I was elected in a district that included Yorkville, East Harlem, and part of Central Harlem, actually. And I beat a longtime councilman by the name of John Murley, who was the organization candidate and came out of one of the old Italian clubs in East Harlem, 116th Street,
sure,
having been an Italian center in the city. So I and got elected sort of on the coattails of the Swagner movement. So I became a councilman in 62. And as I told someone in my oral history, when I was elected, Mayor Wagner called me into his office and he said, "I want you to be chairman of the buildings department." And I said, "Well, Mr. Mayor," I was always respectful of him, and I never called him Wag or Bob, even though I'd known him pretty well. He said, "Well, you know, John Jones, who was from the Bronx, he wasn't too reliable. Actually, there was allegations that he had his hand in the till, so, or at least in return for legislation, there was some shenanigans." He says, "Bob, I know I can count on you, and later on we'll find something else for you," which indicates how much power Wagner had over the council at this time. He was determining who the committee chairmen were going to be. So that's an interesting sidelight. So I became the chairman of the buildings committee. And 8 years later, I was still chairman of the buildings committee because Wagner didn't run again in 65. Menzies was elected. And so I was always chairman of the buildings committee.
Now, did that explain why you were one of the three co-sponsors of the Landmarks legislation, or is there another reason how you ended up in that role?
I think I sort of volunteered getting in on it in this way, that since I was represented at least in part a rather sophisticated area of the city, it was the kind of thing that appealed to me and my constituents. If I had represented some distant borough or district in an outer borough, I might not have been as interested. But it was the kind of thing that I wanted to get involved with.
Did your district, how far south of Yorkville did your district go? Do you remember
that? At that point, I didn't go much below, I'm guessing now, but about 70th Street.
Okay.
When I was re-elected, I went all the way, I think, down to 57th or 59th Street, and Central Harlem was cut out of the district. Go ahead.
That sounds right. I actually used to work for a councilwoman who I think ended up representing the reincarnation of your district, Jane Trichter. And I think it was District 7, and at that time it kind of went more like 96th Street and then down to into the
50th, 70th
side.
Well, I always had East Harlem.
Yeah, that's maybe when they made the change.
Oh, I had a very district.
Yeah. Now, there was David Todd, Bill Ginsburg. Do those names mean anything to you? There was some kind of Reform Democrat group over there on the east side.
I remember Bill Ginsburg pretty well.
Yeah.
And he became a professor out on
Hofstra
College, and was very interested in the environmental aspects, and I think got involved in the impact statement, etc.
Mm-hmm. That would make sense.
But I don't remember what part he may have played in. Yeah.
You don't remember whether he was active when you in 62, in 61 when you were running? I just know that there was some kind of program.
He was, we had these political clubs in those days. You had the regular clubs and the reform clubs, and I think he was active in the Lexington Club, which was sort of the elite club in the whole city, because it represented Park Avenue and so on, and they had a pretty powerful place. I think he was involved there. My recollection.
Does the name Alice Sachs mean anything to you?
Sure.
Was Alice involved? Because I know she was involved well. I only knew her within the last 20 years, but I know she was involved well back.
She was the powerhouse there for many years. And while the male district leader changed a few times, I think she's held right in there. She was a maiden lady, and she gave her life to this. She was
a focus.
Powerful woman.
Yeah. So you were, at the time the bill was actually introduced, the land use law was introduced on October 6th of 1964, and it was sponsored by yourself, Seymour Boyers, and Richard Aldrich. Any insight you can give us on how they got involved? I mean, why their names, why they were also co-introducers, is that?
I can't tell you about Boyers, but I say he's the key here. You right. have to talk to him. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know, does he claim he's too busy or what?
No, no, we had one conversation with him, and we're probably going to do another one.
Yeah, because he probably remembers it. This mm-hmm. was, this may have been the high point in his time in the council. Mm-hmm. In my case, it was important, but as I told you on the right. phone, the air pollution thing was the thing that I
really capped your career, yeah.
months on, and it was about as innovative at that time as landmarks preservation. Most people don't remember that the word environment didn't mean a hell of a lot in 1965 or 66. And
it's interesting that both of these things happened in that time frame, the landmarks, kind of the built environment in 65, and then the environmental bill you were talking about in 66. Is it just the moment, or just a coincidence, or any thoughts
well,
on that?
Well, I don't know what got Wagner going on this. He knew Jack Felt. Jim Felt was the man who owned the building that went up on the Penn Station.
That was Jack's brother, right?
That's Jack's brother.
Yeah.
And I think Jack was the chairman of the
City Planning.
City Planning right. Committee.
Absolute
so
commission.
So I
right.
don't know what might have gotten him interested. But Wagner did adopt a number of, you might say, forward-looking actions that he went with. I mean, he wasn't out there waving his arms, but he backed them up. I mean, I remember the fight over fluoridation of the water.
Huh.
And Leona Baumgartner was the health commissioner, and she was really appointed totally on the merits. She was had no political connections. And he took the heat, and it was heat. I mean, we who supported fluoridation were called communists and every other thing you can imagine. I mean, the heat in that was very, very hot. So Wagner would go along with these things that were forward-looking, and I don't know who brought it to him. I'm sure he didn't sit down and dictate a bill.
Well, you're right. I mean, Felt was certainly quite involved
was it,
in the process.
Jack Felt?
Well, Felt seems to have been the person within the administration who helped move it
really?
Along.
Yeah. Well, there's an interesting yeah. fact that I hadn't reflected on, but well, he and his brother, were they on the outs?
Well, let's speculate on that just for a minute, because when you look at all of this, the effort to create the landmarks law was always just a few steps behind what was going on with Pennsylvania Station. And at one point, I did have a chance, I think, to ask Jeffrey Platt, it's either Jeffrey Platt or Harmon Goldstone, if they felt there was, you know, this whole odd, the two Felts on opposite sides of this. And they both, whichever one I spoke to on it, I've got it in a printed interview, made it very clear that they felt that James Felt was such a man of integrity that they couldn't even fathom that there would be anything that had gone on between him and his brother.
Oh, no, the fact that it came later, no.
Yeah.
I would doubt that. But he was in the real estate business himself.
Right, prior to becoming, I think he became the head of city planning in January of 1956, is when Felt was appointed planning commissioner. And then launched that whole zoning reform, which, you know.
Say
1956? 1956. I'm pretty comfortable with that, because I think I just read it this afternoon. Otherwise, I wouldn't trust my memory. But
Well, 61 is when the new zoning goes in, and it took right. several years to do the study and city planning, so.
After this?
Before.
So that's why he would have had to be there in the middle 50s to get the study launched.
The new zoning came in place first, and in fact, that had to
That was 61?
61 is the new zoning.
Right. And in essence, that had to be done first, in a sense, before they could focus on the preservation. That
was
the politics. Well,
it may have been Jack Felt that was behind this thing then. And I don't know about the rest of the country, whether there were efforts that candidated this. I don't know if this was a pioneering effort. You probably do know that.
Well, that's a word. Dorothy actually teaches a course that goes into that in great detail, but it was certainly cutting edge, I think, in
many ways.
Was
it really?
Well, part of it was.
Yeah.
The part of it that was cutting edge is, since, and I don't know if when you were, you know, dealing with this law, people talked about, well, other parts of the country have it. Did that come up at all? Did people say, well, they have it in New Orleans and Savannah or Charleston, and we can have it or something?
I don't remember that there was any such thing. But even in my mind, there was a question of taking, you know, the word taking.
Sure.
Right.
You're taking somebody's property without compensation. And I'm sure that's been a battle, and I guess constitutionally these things are all have been held up long since.
Right. That's the Penn Central case, yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
Okay. But you see, you know, as a lawyer, I did think of that. You're telling a guy what he can do with his property he paid for, and, you know,
it'd be interesting what type of debate ensued. Just to set the stage, if my research is correct, it was December 3rd of 1965 is when the council actually held its public
64.
Hearing. I'm sorry, 64. I'm losing my mind here. It was December 64 that the council held the public hearing on the law. And I think the just a little background, if you might have a thought on this. According to the research I've done, the mayor... The draft of the Landmarks Law, which was being prepared by the Mayor's Landmarks Commission at that time, was given to the mayor.
Wait a minute, Landmarks Commission
was
in existence.
There was a temporary one.
There was one created by mayoral order.
Really?
Without any legislative authority, and it was really given two assignments in that early period. One was to draft a law, and the other was to begin...
Working with the law department.
And the other was to begin to do basic survey work, begin to identify what we might care about if we had a law, what we might consider.
Yeah, but I think Jack Felt then must have had a big part to
play
in this.
Oh, absolutely. No,
does Whitney North Seymour Sr. mean anything?
Seymour?
Whitney North Seymour.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, Senior. Yeah. Not,
well,
not,
Senior. Not
Mike, not Mike, the was later a...
State Senator.
Well, and U.S. Attorney, But the father was very active on that committee, and yet he was very distinguished, you know, in international bar associations and so on. And
the sponsors before.
Yeah.
You see, Aldrich, who was sort of from that media, he might have gotten interested through some of those people. And, of course, he was running... I don't remember whether he was councilman at large. We used to, in order to get Republican representation, there was a time when we had one Republican at large and one Democrat at large in Eastboro. And I think he may have been the Republican at large.
You can check that
out. And, you know, he represented the Silk Stockton district, if you will, where this kind of thing would appeal.
Well, no, absolutely. Well, I'll hold that thought for a minute just to follow up on this. So this committee, the Mayor's Landmarks Commission, prior to the law, presented to the mayor a draft in May of 1964. And then it sat with the mayor until the hearing in December when... Well, actually, it was given to the council, obviously, sometime in the fall, and then there was the hearing in December. And I don't know if you have any memories of the hearing from the research I've done. According to the records, apparently, there were 84 people who testified, which was apparently quite a number. 85 testified in support and 5 in opposition.
Really?
Didn't the real estate
board oppose this?
Apparently there was token opposition. I think that they had been approached and worked on.
That there was something in the law, and maybe Felt's role. I mean, this at the point when you received it, you remember being concerned about takings. Do you remember feeling that it was controversial?
Well, I thought so.
Yeah.
This impacts on the real estate business.
Uh-huh.
In other words, here recently, you gave the date what is it, the 16th today?
Today, yep. Yeah,
16th of July, 2002, and we're sitting in the Fuller Building. A new owner took over this place recently, and your listeners or readers will know that the Fuller Building is a magnificent Art Deco building. It's almost one of a kind in New York. He wanted to redo the whole lobby. He said he couldn't rent in this building because he had to modernize the library, the lobby. Well, there was a big battle over that, and they finally withdrew the application to redo the lobby. And the new owners had heavy hitters working on this, including Mr. Lindenbaum, whose father I knew well, Bunny.
Right, right.
And so the battle continues.
Absolutely.
But at least in the context of a public hearing, because it's an individual right. landmark and an interior landmark for the lobby. Yeah.
You know, when you talk...
Well, it is a different situation.
Yeah. So the battle continues, but the fight, you know, is now in a public forum. And because it was so public, I think that's why he pulled back.
Well, our mutual friend came through this building on a Saturday going to the galleries.
Yeah. Penelope.
Penelope Barrow.
Who helped.
And she got, I think, three different gallery owners to come down to the hearing, which was pretty good stuff because she went in cold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And these gallery owners, many of them are here because of the character of the building.
Right. Absolutely.
I ran into Lindenbaum in the lobby a few weeks ago. And I said, "Do you represent the owner?" I said. He said, "Yes." I said, "You know, I don't think the new owner understands the character of the building nor its tenants." And his reply was, "Well, you know, that ceiling wasn't the original ceiling," which is like answering an allegation that isn't being made.
Right.
Which the present administration in Washington is very adept at doing.
It's a political trait. Well, speaking of preservation battles, this is an interesting one because you, representing the area you represented, at that time, there were several key preservation struggles that politically set the stage, I think, for moving the law along. In the fall of that year of 64, the Brokaw Mansions, which I think might have been in your district.
No, that's on Fifth Avenue.
Did you go over to Fifth or not?
No, he was
never went to Fifth.
Okay, because the Brokaw battle was in the fall of 64. They announced that they were going to demolish it, and that actually led to protests on the Upper East Side. And I think Alice was, that's why I asked about Alice Sachs. Mm-hmm. I think she was at one of those, if not helped
but
lead
it. I certainly remember that name, but I cannot visualize exactly.
Picture 79th Street on the corner of Fifth Avenue, and on the south side, on the north side, were very ornate, real townhouses, mansions. And the south side one still exists. It's the Ukrainian Institute. And on the north side was a comparable, very ornate, you know, highly Gothic type of mansion. But now there's a large apartment building.
But on the south, that's where the new museum is.
No, that's 86th Street.
Austrian Museum?
Yeah, you're up at 86.
That you're at 86, moved down to 79th. Yeah, okay. No, that's the 70. That was also a fight later when we heard that for designation.
Because it was apparently the threat to the Brokaw Mansion in the fall that helped the mayor move the draft legislation to the city council. And then after the city council hearing in December, the hearing we were just asking about, in December there was a threat to the Percy Pine Mansions on Park Avenue. And I don't know if those ring any bells for you. They're across from Hunter College.
What you tell me now, you see, as an ex-political animal, I can see now a little bit more Wagner's interest in this. You see, his executive assistant was Julius Edelstein, who came out of this reform movement. He had been Senator Lehman's executive assistant in Washington. Nobody knows I'm here, do they? Hello? And Wagner would see that some of the key constituencies here that came from that reform movement that put him in were behind this. And maybe Alice Sachs and some of those people actually had a meeting with him and said, hey, Mr. Mayor, blah, blah, blah. So that's an important facet, that they were, that these local political people in the Silk Stocking District were
and these
getting involved.
And these particular battles were receiving lots of press, you know, in the New York Times, so they,
sure.
were, they weren't
sure.
quiet little struggles. They were pretty pretty public at that point.
Cut a political man, the mayor of New York, off from political yeah. interest pressures.
I believe at that time the president of the city council was a guy named Ross. R-O-S-S. Does
he
that,
was the majority leader.
That's, I'm sorry, that's what I was reaching for, the majority leader of the city council. Do you have any memories of his involvement with the bill, if any? That, whether he was...
Well, as I think I pointed out, the council did what the mayor and the leaders told him to do. And Ross came out of the old guard organization in the Bronx. And he ran a tight ship. I mean, if a councilman wanted to get something done, he better stay in line with other things that, you know, maybe didn't directly concern him. So Ross would carry the ball. If this was the mayor's bill, he would say, you know, let's get this done. But I don't think he had
a particularly personal
interest. Dave Ross passed away 2 or 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, can't get to him anymore. There's not too many of us left.
Well, that's one reason we want to take opportunities to meet when we can.
You better hurry up.
Well, I think you'll be around for quite a while, which would be great, because we'll be sending you a transcript of this to proof anyway. Well, the law, after that hearing in December, there were, as I say, a couple other big controversies over Christmas. Was this fight over these buildings on Park Avenue, the Percy Pine Mansions, and then the Brokaw Mansions.
As which, by the way, in terms of the base, it was one of the Rockefeller heiresses, one of the women who helped bail that
yeah,
out.
The Marquesa de Cuevas.
So once again, it was moneyed east side coming in. Moneyed east side coming in and taking a pro-preservation public stance.
Right. Yeah. And that controversy happened over Christmas, New Year's, and then a couple of months later, the Brokaw Mansions, which had sparked this debate in the fall. The debate, they hadn't demolished them in the fall; they just announced they were going to. But I don't have the date here. It was in February, in early February, they actually demolished.
65.
Now 65, mm-hmm. Right. They actually demolished the Brokaw Mansions over a weekend, and there were all sorts of flurries in the press. And that seems to have provided the impetus to then move the bill actually to be taken to a vote at the council, which happened in
April. Well, now
Lindsay's
mayor.
65,
right? Oh, no, not until the fall.
Till the fall. So we still got Wagner. So on April 6th...
Wagner signed, yeah.
Yeah. On April 6th of 65 is when actually the council voted on it, and I think 33 of the 35, two members abstained, I guess, but 33 voted for it. So once again, that sounds like, would that have been kind of Mr. Ross potentially delivering the council, and also with the kind of public flurry over it, there was clearly a climate at that time. Does any of this trigger... Do you have any memories of those events, or?
I wish I could tell you yes, but.
I can't remember what happened 3 weeks ago, so these are grossly unfair questions, but we asked them anyway.
I can't remember what I did last weekend. You know, it's tough. Sometimes people remind me of things. I met recently with Richard Lane, who had been the district leader in that Lenox Hill Club.
Oh, great.
And he reminded me of things that I didn't remember at all. I mean, his memory was just a lot better. But I don't remember. I think I did attend a lot of the committee hearings. You say there were about three?
Well, there was one that I know of, the one in December, and I haven't identified others. I can't imagine there were, though. There must have been many meetings.
You can get this stuff.
There may have been meetings rather than hearings. There may have just been the
you
one
can night. Get that stuff either from the municipal library or from the archives, because they also published a little book. It wasn't a transcript of what happened, but as a matter of fact, I have a copy of the type of thing, which would tell you what was going on in a very formalistic way. It's a little bit like the congressional record.
Would that have been kind of announcing the hearings in advance, or actually kind of a write-up of what actually transpired?
Yeah, it would tell you what bills went in, it would reproduce the bills, it would reproduce the results, and so on. And I think you can find that stuff.
Okay, great. Now that's one
of
my
next. I'm not sure they have it out at Long Island City yet, LaGuardia.
When you would put your name on a bill, would you obviously have read it, but would you have expected to really go over it, or because you were chair of the building committee, part of your role would just be to move the bills that were appropriate for your committee?
Well, this bill didn't come before our committee.
Right,
I think Boyers was chairman of the government operations.
That's where it would have been.
Yes, it was.
Right,
it was government ops.
But your name was nonetheless on it.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Well, I could get on it by making enough noise or talking to Dave mm-hmm. Ross or mm-hmm. whatever, mm-hmm. and then I get on the bill. But I don't remember the exact circumstances, mm-hmm. but let me say this, because we're talking very frankly about this situation, and I'm an ex-political animal. This kind of a bill appealed more to the people in Manhattan than it did to the people in Staten Island, let us say. The protests and all for demolition were here. They weren't out in Jamaica Bay or someplace. So that it would be more important for a political figure, a councilman in Manhattan, to get into the act to identify with this type of bill than it would be for some guy like, well, even Boyers out in Queens, but he happened to be chairman of the committee. So
would that probably explain why he was co-sponsor, because it was his committee?
Yeah. I don't know what they're doing here. Anyway,
so Boyers was Queens.
The bill probably went there because Ross either didn't want to give me any more work or any more notoriety, and thought he'd be safer with Boyers. That's possible. Now, that's supposition, that's guess.
No, but that's interesting.
But government operations, wasn't that the logical committee to send it to, or it wasn't so logical then, necessarily?
Well, I think he might have had a choice.
Uh-huh.
I don't know for sure.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Well, you were meanwhile already interested in your air pollution bill at this point?
Well, let's see. I could give you those dates. I don't have them in my head, but I think all through 64,
uh-huh.
and then 65, and the bill was finally signed by Lindsay in 66. So I think we started up in June of 64 or
uh-huh.
thereabouts. And that thing, frankly, we generated so much publicity, a little bit like what happened here.
Mm-hmm.
But we had scare headlines about what happened in Dannemora, Pennsylvania, what happened in London, and then there was a big story out of Toronto, and one thing or another, so that when the bill actually got introduced, we had a banner headline across the front page of the World Telegram that the council will hold hearings. And Dave Ross and the president of the council, Paul Scrivain, got their names on the bill, which was very unusual, but they wanted to get aboard the issue.
Right. And now that was a bill that the council, under your leadership, actually generated, as opposed to the administration. And did you have a heavy fight in terms of getting the council leadership to support it? I mean, did that happen after the headlines? I mean, was it an uphill battle?
Well, that headline thing was so overwhelming.
That just did it.
That they had to get aboard. Well, you know
the leadership had to get aboard. Also, I might point this out. I don't know if this would apply to your to the bill we're talking about, the landmarks preservation. But you see, when Wagner announced he wasn't running again, or made it clear, then there was a window of opportunity to do things that might sound as if they were critical of the Wagner administration. So there was, I think I've called it a window of opportunity. And
do you happen to remember when the word got out, or he announced, or that people understood he wasn't running again?
Well, it must have been during 55. I don't remember the date.
65.
Yeah, 65. Yeah. All of this would be in the newspaper.
Sure.
You know, one of the things that I'm interested in is sort of, you know, Tony mentioned that the timing of the landmarks, and then the following year, the air one. In Washington, the famous federal legislation, the key is 66. And the environmental, in terms of water and air, is 69. And so there's a linkage, but preservation definitely got there a few years earlier. But when the Supreme Court opinion comes down that Brennan writes in Penn Central's case, he talks about the quality of life. And he obviously sees both the preservation laws and the environmental laws as quality of life issues and quality of life laws. Was there any of that feeling, do you think, back in 66 when you had the landmarks law and then you get the air pollution the following year? Were they seen at all as relating to each other in terms of the quality of life in New York City as a whole? Because this, your air pollution was obviously a citywide one, less Manhattan oriented.
Well, it might have been. But as with many things, I think it was a small group of activists.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I say that for this reason. The very strong air pollution activists were all in favor of putting bridge tolls on the East River bridges. The plazas for the tolls would be in Brooklyn and in Queens, which would then have the pollution from the cars.
Yeah.
Well, that, I don't think those people thought about that too much. And you see, it was Manhattan pushing this stuff and Manhattan's counterparts elsewhere. So there may well have been that quality of life, that issue that came together here. Neither here nor there, but on the side, I recently saw a poll that came out in 1999 on the question of bilingual education in New York City. All the boroughs supported it heavily, which meant that minority students, the Hispanic-speaking students, their parents supported it as well as everybody else. But in Manhattan, the approval rating was way down. It was better than 50%. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because you have the New York Times editorial writers and their followers espousing things like this. But it didn't necessarily impact in Queens or Bronx.
The mention of the
I hope I'm not giving too much of a political.
No, but this is very
but
helpful.
That was the role you were playing in the 60s.
Yeah, and we're also trying to understand these events through as many different lenses as we can. So having a political climate is extremely helpful.
Well,
you
I don't mean to be too cynical about the thing, but I'm trying to give you some feeling of what kind of pressures would get this thing moving.
Well, you mentioned the New York Times just in the last example, and the New York Times certainly was very strongly supporting the whole push for the landmarks law, and I think also were they equally supportive of the air pollution?
We had editorials. I was a man in the news. We had front page stories.
Was that John Oakes at the New York Times?
I assume it was.
Yeah, that's also been the assumption on the preservation
and
piece.
I once wrote him a note about it, and he didn't reply because I knew him and his wife
But I have to assume that he was behind this. He was a very strong advocate of these environmental factors and of the, as you say, of the preservation. But somehow, in our case, that is the air pollution, we got editorial supports in the Post and in the Journal American and the Herald Tribune. All these papers are, some of them are defunct, but it was broad. So in that case, everything went. Now, I don't know whether you had support in those other papers for landmarks. I mean, I don't remember.
Yeah.
You'd have to look at the papers.
I don't think there was, my sense is there was no voice stronger than the New York Times, but I also remember seeing article, major feature articles in some of the other newspapers about some of these landmark battles, like
right.
the whole Brokaw thing. So there certainly was coverage in the
it
others.
It was broader than just
yeah.
Manhattan.
But I honestly can't say that I myself have seen editorials from the others. So.
I haven't. You know, Brooklyn Heights was very strong for the preservation
oh, yeah,
law,
could
too.
See that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that would be important.
Actually, there were. I mean, your Manhattan, you know, issue is right. Strong Manhattan voice. And within Manhattan, I think the Upper East Side, because they were losing
sure.
these buildings. But Greenwich Village
oh, sure.
was also an extremely
oh,
strong
sure.
voice for many, many years,
yeah.
as with Brooklyn Heights. And I don't know from a political perspective what that adds into the equation. You know, being
well, it was important because you see down there, Koch was elected and beat DeSapio down there for the leadership. He was generating issues that would appeal to the people who lived in Greenwich Village. And DeSapio was passé, you might say, on that type of thing. So,
and I don't know in terms of the politics how Brooklyn Heights.
Oh, well, I'm
the
sure
council,
they got behind this, too.
Well, we know the Heights was indeed behind it, but I don't know from a political perspective if those council members would add much to the power structure
really
or not.
I don't remember, but I'm sure the Brooklyn Heights representative was involved.
Yeah,
and Mr. Arculeo, who was the minority leader, he might have been the only Republican. He probably was... He might have been for it too,
you
although
know,
I don't know for sure.
I have one other name I just wanted to run by you who's come up in some of the research, who was someone who worked for the mayor, a guy named Bill Lutsky.
Oh, right? Sure.
What role was he just playing generally for the mayor?
Jack Lutsky.
Jack? Okay, thanks.
Jacob, actually. He was a very key man. He knew the charter inside out. He knew the statutes inside out. He knew who everybody was and what they could and could not do.
Did he have an official title or?
He had a title, whether he was counsel to the mayor or whatever. But
he was a lawyer?
He was a lawyer, but he was a brilliant man on this type of municipal structure.
I think it was Jeffrey Platt referred to him as the mayor's get-it-all-done man.
Yeah, well, if the mayor didn't show up at a meeting, and the mayor, this Mayor Wagner, went to meetings. He went to Board of Estimate meetings where things happened.
Right.
And if he had to step out or he wasn't there for some reason, Jack Galinsky would sit in his chair and he could determine what the mayor wanted. So he was a very powerful person. But I mean, he reflected the mayor. He didn't go off on his own.
Right. So his involvement would show the mayor's level of commitment in terms of carrying
sure,
it through.
I'm sure he had something to do with the legislation.
Right.
He probably reviewed it and maybe argued with Jack Feld or whatever. He was a hell of a guy. He never had to have a book or anything. He just knew this stuff.
Yeah, the name was Galitsky or Lutsky?
Lutsky.
L-U-T-S-K-Y. L-U-T-S-K-Y. Very significant factor in those days.
Uh-huh.
You have to remember that the staff at City Hall in those days was a lot smaller than it is today. There were only two deputy mayors. I think one for finance and one for operations, And then there were four or five assistants, and each of whom had responsibilities for certain areas of city government. We had one man whose own sole job was education, and the rest of us had little packages of city agencies and our responsibility.
Well, before you went on the city council, were you working in City Hall for the mayor?
Yes.
Yeah, and so what your particular responsibility was what at City Hall in those days?
Well, to the best of my recollection, I had like the Department of Health, the Department known then as Welfare, mm-hmm. and hospitals.
Did you have city planning or
Commission on Human Rights, mm-hmm. which was the forerunner of the sort of affirmative action business. So those were at least
coming out of a Eleanor Roosevelt concern too. Again, I guess.
Well, they were more or less the social mm-hmm. service agencies, mm-hmm. as distinguished from sanitation or general services or, you know.
Right. And had you gone to law school already by then, or yes. did you go later? You'd gone to law school. Yeah. Where'd you go?
George Washington.
Uh-huh. In Washington.
Well, I worked mm-hmm. as an assistant to Senator Lehman, mm-hmm. and after that I worked briefly for a congressman from the state of Washington who became my buddy and political mentor, whose name was Henry M. Jackson, who then became a senator. I worked for Jackson for about 4 months, and then I went to the State Department. Mm. And how do we get into this? Law school. And I went to law school at night while I was in the State Department. Mm-hmm.
What area in the State Department were you in?
Well, I worked for the legal advisor. Uh-huh. I was not a lawyer at the time, but the legal advisor at that time was a very key player in the Truman administration, because Acheson was the Secretary of State, and he had great confidence in Adrian Fisher, who was the legal advisor, and Adrian Fisher used to go with Acheson over to the White House and discuss matters with Truman. So we had all the hot potatoes to deal with in his office, like the firing of General MacArthur.
So this is the early 50s then, like 51, 52?
Yeah, MacArthur's mm-hmm. attacks mm-hmm. on personnel in the State mm-hmm. Department. The confirmation hearings of Phil Jessup, who's a Columbia mm-hmm. law professor. These are names that may be antedate your...
But I certainly knew of Jessup. My father taught at Columbia, so I lived up there. Growing
Jessup
up,
was
yeah, very distinguished.
Affairs.
He wasn't when I went to Columbia Law School. He was, I never had him as a professor, but he was certainly, well known.
Now, are you a New Yorker by native, or did you?
Well, I'm really New Yorker by native, although I was born in Scarsdale, which.
Oh, then you're not a New Yorker by.
The greater metropolitan region.
I'm told that in those days it was really more or less country. Yeah. There were farms and stuff. Mm-hmm. But I've been here most of my life, but I went to prep school out of the city, and I went to college on the West Coast. I was in the Navy almost 5 years, and then I came back here, but I spent 4 years in Washington. Since then, I've been here.
And where'd you go to college?
On the West Coast? Stanford University.
Stanford. Oh, that's how you got to the Bay Area.
Yes.
The decision to go to leave Washington and come to New York to work for Wagner.
Well, there was a certain unpleasantness in the fall of 1952 when General Eisenhower was elected president, and I saw the writing on the wall, mm-hmm. and I resigned from the State Department, mm-hmm. and then went to law school full time mm-hmm. for a year or so I mm-hmm. could finish up. Then I came up here, and I practiced law, and I worked in Wagner's campaign, I think. And then
And were you living, I know you live on the Upper East Side now, did you live?
I've been there since 1954, I think.
So when you came back, almost when you came back?
I've been 28 years in the same apartment.
Oh.
And you're going to give it up?
We've got a week to get out.
Well, you've been so generous with your time.
No,
I have a couple more questions.
Okay, but I just want to be conscious of your time.
I enjoy this, but I'm not contributing a hell of a lot, I know.
This is actually quite very helpful to me, but Dorothy, you have some more
questions. Yeah, no, I have
questions.
Some questions. I'd like to go back. You said something about it being cutting edge and, you know, the takings issue. And a landmarks law, historic preservation law as such, by 65, was not in and of itself cutting edge. We had about 35 years of historic preservation legislation around the country. What was cutting edge in New York was that the decision was made not to just do historic districts, but to do also individual landmarks. And Schenectady had already passed a law in 59 that did that, and there were a few other places. But that was what was really cutting edge, was to not just go with districts. And that's where the takings issue comes up much more, is the individual landmark, and that's the Supreme Court case in Penn Central. Do you remember in any way thinking of that distinction between whether something was an individual landmark or a district when you were dealing with the legislation? I mean, your reaction to the takings issue shows that, you know, looking at the law in general, you sort of, I don't know, maybe you're almost amazed that we got it through, or, you
no,
know,
no,
that it's worked
no,
so well.
No, I just... You know, it's like law now, the financial reform law in Washington.
Right.
I'm all for it, but I still am not sure how the Supreme Court
on the First Amendment issue. Yeah.
First Amendment issues.
Right.
Well, that
right.
didn't lessen
yeah.
my support.
Right.
And then the same thing with respect mm-hmm. to the landmarks preservation.
Mm-hmm.
But an aside.
Mm-hmm.
A friend of mine was mayor of Schenectady at the time, Sam Stratton.
Uh-huh.
And I wondered whether he had some role to play. He later became a congressman and died prematurely. He'd been in Congress for, I don't know, four or five terms.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a sort of a reform mayor in Schenectady.
And how did you happen to know him?
How I got to know Sam
mm-hmm.
or his wife Joan, who was a beautiful Scottish lady, but we were very close
mm-hmm.
social friends.
Mm-hmm.
You know, speaking of the Supreme Court, let me just mention another name and see if it triggers any memories for you. One thing that helped the advocacy efforts behind the law in the mid-50s was the Berman v. Parker decision by the Supreme Court. That decision legislation to allow cities in New York State to have local landmark laws.
It's very vital that had to come first.
Absolutely. It was a key step, but I wonder just if I mentioned that only to see if it triggered any memories during the debate at the city council about the law, if anyone did reference that kind of legislative or legal foundation.
Well, it must have been, because
yeah.
we couldn't have gone forward, apparently, without the state legislation.
It's very general. It's amazingly general.
That home
yeah.
rule business, and nobody understands
and
it yet, except Jack Lutsky.
Right.
Well, back then.
But also
right.
Schenectady, see, in 59. 56 is Bard Act. 59 is the Schenectady. I wonder
yeah.
if your friend was mayor in 59.
Do a little research in the municipal libraries.
Right. And then see, and then it starts, you know, this whole effort to get one through in
I
New
think
York.
He was mayor.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was mayor,
yeah.
but I don't know whether
mm-hmm.
he had anything to do with this.
Well, he must have, obviously you wouldn't have it in Schenectady when it was so unusual.
Dorothy, have you stumbled on anything that suggests that the Schenectady example was used in New York?
No, that's why I'm curious. You know, this is the first link I've met is, they're all socializing at the country club. Well,
yeah.
I don't know. They're, you know, somehow, you know, it was reassuring to have a friend who, you know, as mayor had done something
yeah.
comparable in their town.
Well, Sam was a heck of a guy, and he never went further statewide
mm-hmm.
because as a young man, he had traveled in Germany
mm-hmm.
and he had said something good about the Nazis or...
Yeah.
what was going on there, and of course that killed him.
Mm-hmm.
So he never could run statewide or anything, but he was one hell of a guy. You know, those things happen.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of, it sounds like, if I understand, that in other words, the real debate on the provisions and the law and the different decisions that were made about individual designation, or, you know, whether it should be separate from the city planning, or whether there should be a hardship procedure in the law or a over Board of Standards Appeals, all that was really done off stage. It really wasn't done, you know, you all were handed sort of a bill that had been drafted and vetted off stage. Is that sort of the way
it worked? Yeah, but if you talk to Boyers, he brags about the fact that we amended the bill.
Uh-huh.
You have to get the specifics from him.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I think I told you.
Yeah, you did indeed mention that over the phone briefly, and that's
I had a discussion with him once, and he said, "Well, we amended the bill."
Mm-hmm.
Now, in what respects?
Mm-hmm.
He must know.
Right.
There was,
and can I just and then, you know, the person who drafted it at the time was somebody named Bernie Friedlander, who actually was in the law department in the court council. Do you remember him?
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember him in connection with this bill, or you just remember him in general in connection with other things?
I haven't heard his name in I don't know how many years, but I certainly could see him as if he were sitting here, and I don't know if he's still around.
Well, when I left, I was a Giuliani reject, so I left shortly after Mr. Giuliani.
You've been there a long time then.
I was there 20 years.
Oh, my.
Right, and then Mr. Giuliani came, and I'd been there all of, you know, I've been there under Beam, all of Koch, all of Dinkins, but apparently it was a campaign commitment that I would go, you know, that somebody asked for, and Mr. Giuliani did not know me from a hole in the wall, so I don't take it personally. But anyway, so when the new chair came under the Giuliani administration, the first thing she
did. Who was that, Rose?
A Rapp.
Rose was city planning.
Jennifer Rapp was landmarks, and Joe Rose was city planning. And so the first thing she had to do was get rid of me. So she did. So I've been gone since then. Well, I don't think we would have rubbed well together. They didn't need a campaign commitment once.
Really?
You know, they probably, we wouldn't have.
You might not have lasted long.
That's right. They should have just let it play its natural course. It wouldn't have caused as much hoopla. The way it happened, there was a lot of, you know,
what's
outcry.
What's hoopla?
There was, is that fair?
It's fair to say.
Yeah. There was even a little something in the real estate section, because I was very well respected and I'd had a very good record while I was there.
The reason Dorothy was asked to leave was a testimony to how effective she was in, you know, administering the law.
I was treated everybody the same. I think that was the real problem. It wasn't just that we were winning, but that there. I think there was one particular person who wasn't used to being treated the same as everybody else. And as far as I was concerned, everybody was the same. There was not special treatment.
The guy was pretty ruthless, let's put it that way.
I think that's a good assessment.
The way he got rid of the Board of Education chancellors, I mean, that's pretty crude. You know, you hang out somebody and, you know, you make it so unpleasant.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know if you get this, but, you know, when you go around literally the rest of the world, everybody says, oh, Mayor Giuliani, wasn't he wonderful? And I'd say, yes, for those few days after September 11th, you know, to have a bully in charge was the right thing, but it didn't mean it was what the city needed normally.
Well, as I go around out west and so on, I feel the same way. There were a lot of negatives about Giuliani, no question about it. But he got away with this heroic posture.
9/11 saved his reputation.
It.
Yeah, saved him and made him, absolutely.
But you notice that the Republican Party is not doing much for him. And I think the reason probably is his matrimonial problems. That wouldn't go over too well with
most of America.
The Republican Party.
I think your political instincts are very much on point there.
Well, and also, you know, he's not really a sharer.
No, he's going to be in charge or else.
Yeah.
And no, I have my misgivings about him. On the other hand, I felt that Dinkins really, and he was a friend of mine. I knew him since he was city clerk, which meant he was running around the council. Wasn't very effective. I thought we needed a change, something stronger. And I have to admit that I haven't pulled the
Republican lever or independent lever more than three or four times in my life.
You're on tape here, so we have to.
But the second time around, I pulled it for him.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And, you know, I had my misgivings later, or even when I did that.
Yeah.
You know, you just mentioned the council again, and I wanted to jump back to something that triggered a thought about a comment Dorothy had made. And with a piece of legislation, I mean, back at that moment in time with Wagner in charge, when the administration came forward with a bill, it sounds like they would have hammered out all the big issues off stage before they actually even introduced it at the council, and that the council hearing primarily would have been more or less
perfunctory.
Perfunctory, except as you point out with Boyer's that they did tweak it in
I
some
don't
aspect
know how
that will
much
we'll
tweaking, yeah. Whether it was much more substantial. Yeah. Please talk to him.
Yeah, yeah. No, we'll track that.
He's got to yeah. talk to you. He's yeah. not that important. He should yeah. talk to you. He's
oh, no,
been
it's
a judge
not,
most
yeah.
of his
oh, no,
life.
He the problem's not with him. We had one conversation with him, and we did
and I wasn't there.
Yeah,
we were going
to
do another
follow
one.
It up
yeah.
with
Do you
with
remember
Dorothy.
Much?
He did not, I'll be honest with you, he did not, he was not a font of information. He wasn't being uncooperative. It's just, you know.
Remember?
Well,
if you meet him again,
yeah,
say,
yeah.
you understand that the council adopted certain
right.
amendments to the legislation that was presented
right.
by the Wagner
well,
administration.
There was,
can you remember? Can,
yeah.
can
well,
you
that's
tell
good. We'll set it up that way. There is one clue, and maybe this will trigger a memory, but Jeffrey Platt made the point that in some version, early draft of the law, or some discussion about the law, there was a provision where the commission was going to have a regulatory influence, I think, within 400 feet of the buildings that they designated. And that Platt's memory was that was kind of in there as a bone to throw the opposition, to take it away, in a sense. And that was indeed removed from the discussion. So I'm wondering if that may have been the element that the council changed. We'll have
I
to, but we'll
know.
Follow your
But also, then. When you say off stage, I don't know whether he had any discussions with Boyer's ahead of time,
yeah.
because mm-hmm. when it was delivered, and it had the chairman, the committee's chairman's name on the bill, that means this is kosher.
Right.
Get it passed,
uh-huh.
and that was his mandate. And probably before any amendments were adopted, he probably checked in with Chet Lutsky mm-hmm. or Dave Ross. I don't know.
Now, but and you mentioned Julius Edelstein earlier, but he wouldn't have played a role on this particular matter. This wouldn't have been
No,
his
but
area.
He's around and he's
yeah.
90.
Yeah. But you remember Bernie Friedlander. Now, what would be the context in which you would have met him? He would have come to your meet with your committee or...
Well, I think he was there longer than that, wasn't he?
Oh, Bernie only left the law department around the time I left the commission, so he left about 94.
Yeah,
so,
because you see, I became yeah. a, after I left the council.
Yeah, when did you leave the council, I was going to ask.
Well, 69.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 73, I was appointed administrator of the Environmental Protection Administration, which Lindsay had created.
Oh, right.
And
uh-huh.
then that was... cut back and became the Environmental Protection Commission. Not
Department of Environmental
yes,
Protection.
Yes,
right.
exactly.
Yeah. But they big. There used to be these big administrations under Lindsay originally.
Right,
yeah.
And they cut the sanitation
yeah.
out.
Yeah.
They wanted to be on the parallel with the other uniformed forces, mm-hmm. the police and the fire, which made sense because what I inherited was the tail wagging the dog.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was very... difficult, so mm. that.
But that's where I know you from. I've been trying to think where it was because I know it wasn't the 60s, but I was at the Environmental Defense Fund in 74, 75. But I'd been following environmental issues. I went to planning school in the late 60s after I got my law degree, and that was, you know, where I remember more. Yeah, you know, some
the
of the environmental
Defense Fund.
Right
is that
now,
the
environmental
one
defense.
Bill Duwin headed up?
It's the one, as opposed to NRDC, it's the, I'm trying to think, when I was there, unfortunately, we were in an interregnum, but it's all those guys who were out on at Brookhaven who discovered that, you know, how DDT was affecting the birds, et cetera, so it very much started on a very scientific base, I'm sure I got my job because my grandfather wrote a field guide to the seashore, and they knew my name and were impressed. And they kept saying, you should really rewrite it. And I kept saying, I'm a lawyer. I know nothing about this. But I'm trying to think who headed it originally. Who was the staff person? It's still going. It's one of the two. Jim Tripp is the current general counsel.
I mean, it's not
they
just,
dropped the fund. They just environmental defense. But within
who's John Adams with?
He's NRDC.
Natural Resources Defense Council.
Right, yeah.
They're the two kind of big shops in the environmental advocacy shops in Facebook.
And, in loyalty to EDF, I suppose I should speak up for them more. But actually, I think I'm more sympathetic to NRDC because, I think that they've really tried to make the regulations work and the laws work. It's been a real philosophy of theirs. Whereas EDF has had the philosophy that there's sort of economic issues involved, and if you play the economics right, you'll get the right environmental issue coming out, which I think is true maybe sometimes, but not always.
Now, you were the head of that agency as it went from the larger to the four, and, mm-hmm. and after that,
Regional representative of the Secretary of Energy in New York. You got your seatbelts fastened?
Yes.
New York, New Jersey, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands.
Oh,
sure,
yes.
But that's the district.
That's the great,
that's,
yes.
Yeah, but also, that's what that district court is, our
federal
Court of Appeals is.
So that was, that case, you were back working in the federal administration for the national government.
Right.
That's the Second Circuit.
Right. Yeah.
Well, yes, but it.
I hope you had lots of travel to the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico.
I tell you, on hindsight, I think the Republicans wanted to get eliminate the job, which wouldn't have made much difference if they had, frankly. I mean, I became a spokesman during the fuel crisis in the mid-70s. And so I was making speeches about this and that and the other thing all around, but I didn't have really a lot of operational authority. As a matter of fact, the coupons, the rations, and all that was out of my hands. So it was a little embarrassing at times. People thought I was Mr. Big, but I didn't have anything to do with the main event.
Very interesting. Dorothy, do you have other questions? I am sensitive to the
And from there, what happened? So when you left that, what did you...
Well, then there was an unpleasantness again in 1980. Reagan went in, and I stayed in for 6-8 months, and then I got out. I was in the law business, but now I'm out of everything. And I haven't been in these aspects of life, but I would say one thing. I think I told this to Tony, I'm not sure. But after being involved in the environmental business, particularly air pollution, I felt a little bit the way some of the leaders of the French Revolution must have felt on the way to the guillotine. Because after we passed this bill, there was a primary that fall with Lindsay and Bill Ryan and I don't know who else, and they all competed one with the other in reducing the amount of sulfur permitted in fuel, oil or coal. And it became sort of a ratcheted thing down and not based on much except the politics of it. And then thereafter, in many cases, I really thought that they were going off the deep end because I thought you had to respect, the world we lived in. We live in, for example, putting tolls on the East River bridges. I didn't get any kudos from the environmental groups for this, but I didn't think it was a very good idea, politically or otherwise. So that I never joined any of the new environmental groups. I was the founder of Citizens for Clean Air. And I got a nice plaque from John Wharton thanking me and all that. But I noticed in the paper a year or so back that a young woman who was busy working in New Orleans in good faith is now working for the other side. So she took credit for founding this organization. But
there you go.
Anyway, so I haven't been on the cutting edge, you know?
Sure.
And I know you need this cutting edge to get anything done. On the other hand, some of it is hard for me to take. For example, they outlawed eating swordfish. Why? Somebody got sick from mercury poisoning in swordfish. Well, that person was in the hospital, I found out, in Long Island, and had a prescribed diet of swordfish. Nobody was permitted to eat swordfish for I don't know how many years. And that kind of thing got me a little, you know, off the track. Same thing with the Hudson River. Some of the fish, they tell you, you can't eat the striped bass.
Right. Yeah.
Well, if you ate the fat and the striped bass 3 or 4 times a week, I'm sure that'd be a dangerous matter. But if you eat the fish once or twice a month, I don't see there's anything wrong with it. That's what I mean.
Right.
Well, do you think, you know, looking back, that inevitably one of the patterns, and even obviously the French Revolution is the extreme, but I know that there are probably people involved, well, in our field in historic preservation, who are now amazed at some of the things that are designated. And yet for people who care, there are people out there who care that this kind of thing be preserved. So it gets broadened as a field. The same with the environmental efforts. Is this inevitable that whenever anybody who comes up with a cutting edge bill, you know, that the next generation is going to seem like they've gone further than one met? I mean, do you think politically that's inevitable? Or
probably, now that you ask the question, because I've always been told that a lot of the ideas of Norman Thomas were later acquired by the Democratic administration under Franklin Roosevelt. And now we see that in the present administration in Washington, this isn't necessarily cutting edge, but they've adopted a lot of things that seem far out to them as their own now. So I think you need the extremes to get anything done.
It keeps moving, and
it was some of the particulars, I think. I shouldn't have gotten involved in the particulars, but I couldn't lose sight of them sometimes.
That's understandable.
I don't know about the landmarks. I haven't really followed it, but I think it's fantastic what you've been able to do in the movement. And it's just a wonderful thing.
That's nice to hear that you don't feel it's gone too much off the track. That's great.
I have a friend in San Francisco who's has a prominent name, which you will know. His name is Warburg. He's an architect, and he's the grandfather of the man who had the palace on Fifth Avenue.
Grandson.
Grandson.
Of the Warburg Mansion.
Of the mansion that's now the Jewish Museum.
Right.
And he's made a career of identifying the synagogues in downtown urban areas that have now been abandoned because the Jewish population has become more affluent. They've moved out into the suburbs and so on. And that's a heck of a big undertaking, too.
Yeah.
There's one in San Francisco that's in bad shape.
Well, you know, that's one of the, I would say, one of the cutting-edge areas still for preservation is the challenge of what we view historic religious buildings, whether synagogues with population shifts.
Well, the one that I'm talking about finally was taken over by some Japanese something, and they're going to use it. But
as a religious... Will they use it for religion or as a center?
Yeah, just because.
I tell you the issue in San Francisco that interests me is that you were there, at the Municipal Arts Society this past spring, they had a panel on part of the Place Matters efforts, and somebody from San Francisco was speaking on the same panel I was speaking on, and he identified some of the things coming up that they were looking at, and the one that I sympathized with very much was the place where the Japanese Americans were required to go to sign up to be sent off to the camps during World War II. And, you know, because to me, one of the things that's important in preservation is that we not just have, you know, the glory things, but we also get reminded of when we did it wrong and, you know, let people down under our own constitution.
I don't even know where that place is.
I don't know. He showed us a picture of it, and he said this is one of the things being talked about. But I was pleased that that kind of issue at least was being talked about in California, because the reason I know Southern California is my mother was from there. And, you know, I fear that, you know, my California relatives certainly, you know, did not, you know, think it was wrong at all at the time that, you know, these Americans were being sent off to camps. And, you know, when I look at the cases and, you know, involved in the situations, and, you know, I realize it's hard when you're not in the war that people are in. I think that that kind of thing should be remembered.
Well, I think you're right. I'm in that middle ground myself, because I was recently commissioned in the Navy before we were in the war, and I was assigned in the intelligence branch. I had been in Washington for 3 months, and I obviously needed some more intelligence, and they tried to give it to me in 3 months. But I was assigned to San Luis Obispo, California.
Uh-huh.
Do you know the place?
Yeah, sure, yeah.
It's halfway down.
Yeah. My mother was from, grew up on a citrus and lima bean ranches in Oxnard, California, but in Ventura County, outside the town. So this is just north of there up in. Yeah.
And while I was there, shortly after Pearl Harbor, within 3 weeks, a Japanese submarine actually shelled the fuel tank farm there. And there was such chaos on the West Coast that this was really never publicized, because after Pearl Harbor, maybe irrationally, but people on the West Coast thought they might invade the West Coast.
Right. Yeah, well,
so this wasn't a laughing matter. And if you live through the period, it's easier to understand why this was done, even though in hindsight, it's a terrible thing.
Well,
it's like a war thing.
We're also having, I mean, I think we're reliving part of it now with the whole
keeping people
terrorism.
In jail,
yes.
Right.
Access
well, that's
to
right.
A lawyer.
See, that's why I think it's good to remember.
Yeah.
I mean, because most of those Japanese Americans were very loyal Americans, and it's good for us to remember as we go through the current, you know,
absolutely.
What we did then.
Absolutely.
Well, I think that
I remember as a small child, you know, the talk about the things being found on the beaches, and because, you know, Point Wainema is right there near Ventura. You obviously didn't get to go beyond Luis Obispo. If you go further south, it's where Point Wainema and Point Magoo are, and there were, you know, sort of things washing up on the beach that were thought to be associated with Japanese, and I was a very small child, but I can remember overhearing the adult talk about it and clearly, you know, perceiving the anxiety at the time.
In this particular case, by chance, I was sort of set down in the middle of the of what now is the discussion of it, but I don't remember any discussion at the time.
Yeah.
Well, it's
because
it's
I was shipped out to sea shortly after.
And you went to the Pacific?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think this does point out the one reason historic preservation and the landmarks law is such an important legacy is it's it makes things like this get discussed and keep those memories.
Yeah, because I'm very concerned about the situation now. And
oh,
I
am too.
Yeah.
I mean, to call this thing a war. Yeah. I mean, when is the war over?
Well, and to listen to, obviously as a lawyer, the idea that you can listen in on somebody's conversation with their lawyers, you know, just you don't bring charges that you deny access. And,
I don't get it at all. In other words, the people in Guantanamo, according to the administration, will be held there without access until the war is over. I mean, what war is over?
Well, and also our secretary was quoted, our secretary of the defense was quoted as saying that even those that aren't convicted still shouldn't be let go because they're still guilty of something.
Well, they haven't even been charged, though.
Yeah,
well, it's all quite a...
But anyway, I agree with that totally. And I don't know how I would have my mind changed today. I guess if I were working for Ashcroft, I mean, I might see it differently, but I can't see it differently. It's wrong. Keep people without access to a lawyer, without access to.
Well, that's what I mean. Our whole system is based on access to a lawyer.
It's being perverted terribly. As I asked my friends, tongue in cheek, I said, "What have you done for the war effort lately?" Nobody's done anything for the war effort except the people who were in the National Guard and got sent away and taken out of their jobs. Nobody's done anything for the war effort. What the heck are we doing for the war effort?
Do you feel that this, when you're out in San Francisco, do you feel that the reactions are the same as here in New York? With the people you know here in New York?
Well, I don't know. I travel in a circle that people probably agree with.
We self-select our friends, I realize. Did you come to decide to switch totally to the West Coast?
Well, I have two sons. They both live in San Francisco. And I have six grandchildren. While they're not all there right now, they're based there. My wife has two nieces out there.
Those are compelling reasons to the West Coast.
And we got an apartment there in 1996. Mm-hmm. And so we've been back and forth a lot. And it's not a big emotional wrench for me right now, even though we're moving out of a place we've been in for 48 years. And in fact, presumably I'll be voting in California this fall. And I don't know for whom I'm voting or anything yet.
Maybe you'll run for office in California.
The environment is very important in California, than preservation, than buildings.
That's true.
Yeah. I'm just wondering whether, where did I get this idea? That, it's neither here nor there. That maybe the Republicans had written off California, because I noticed in the list of people released by the IRS who had made use of these offshore tax havens was the name of William Simons Jr. He is the Republican candidate for governor.
Against Davis?
Against Davis. Uh-huh. And he was on the list. Now, as I've said a few times, being an ex-political animal, you know, I don't think that kind of thing would have been done without some okay up top side.
Yes, one may want to connect the dots on that one. Well, look, thanks so much for being so generous with your time, particularly if you're supposed to be home packing. Your wife will never forgive me.
Well,
but
you know something, I'm going to tell you. Turn that off.
Yeah, okay, we'll turn this off. We need to transcribe.